welcome to another edition of Blue Republican Radio for the Liberty Curious. I've been looking forward to this episode for a while. I actually kind of need this episode because I have just got back from Europe and England. I've been teaching Liberty out in Slovenia and the Czech Republic, but then I went to see my family in England for 2.5 weeks. So my head is so far out of American politics now that I need to kind of jolt it back in and remember where I am and start thinking about things that matter, like American liberty. So to that end, I think I've got a good show. The gentleman that I'm going to be introducing you to today is a gentleman that I had the pleasure and privilege of speaking with in Minnesota, his home state, a few weeks ago when Blue Republican Minnesota, we've got a great chapter up there, thanks to a lady called Juliet Nail, she organized the inaugural event for Blue Republican Minnesota. And basically, there were three speakers. I was one. The gentleman you're going to hear from, his name is Frank. Frank Bebo was another. And the other was Chris Ann Hall, who is a lady who I also suspect many of you listening to this show know. And kind of the fun conceit of this event was that we were discussing the topic, does the Constitution work, from kind of three perspectives. I'm the Brit, Chris Ann Hall is the American, and Frank Bebo is the Native American. And all of us have a passion, obviously, about the U.S. Constitution. Now, I have to confess to having been pig ignorant about the experience of Native Americans. And so I learned a lot listening to Frank. I also had the pleasure of having breakfast with him the next day and learning even more. I've invited him on Blue Republican Radio because I obviously am interested, and I know a lot of my friends and colleagues and listeners are interested in the problems with government and the way the state abrogates our rights every minute of every day. Well, of course, there is one culture, or we might even say a series of nations in this land that have been on the receiving end of that. Pretty horrifically, since the white man arrived. And those nations, that culture, other nations and culture, in the lineage of which Frank Bebo was born. And I welcome Frank to the show. Frank, how are you?
I'm excellent, Rob, and you sound like you're actually doing quite well today.
Well, you know, I'm trying to hide the jet lag. So if I'm doing that, I'm happy. So, Frank, you are an attorney. You're a Native American attorney. So whereas people like me, tell the big narratives and get all philosophical, you're the guy actually getting his hands dirty. You are the guy, and correct me if I say anything wrong here, whose job is to protect the rights of individuals, and in your case, Native Americans, who are being screwed by the feds. Now, Native Americans, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, have a special relationship with the feds because you have a direct relationship with the feds that, at least in theory, is not mediated by state government, right? Your rights as the original Americans were retained, and that was a very important point that you made when I listened to you. Those rights were retained because you were here first, as a culture. You were here first in the treaties in the mid-19th century, right? So yeah. Your work as an attorney is within that legal and constitutional framework. Have I said that accurately?
Yes, you have, Robin.
Okay. So now, would it also be fair to say that perhaps the rest of us who live here, the non-Native Americans, you might call us, should be paying closer attention to the Native American experience now than perhaps at any time for many decades?
I would tell you that one of my friends believes we are the canary in the mine.
Tell me more about that.
Well, it makes me think about even like what Mao said in China, what does it matter if the cat is black or white as long as it catches the mouse? And they brought the bottom of their economy up across the board so that everybody was able to prosper. And in the world that I live in, we've been historically disadvantaged, and it seems as though there's an advantage to keeping us oppressed, because then we can't be successful. And if we were successful, we might overshadow some of our neighbors in the way that we could exercise our powers or maybe become more affluent. There are several casinos that people know about that are multi-million dollar casinos every single day. Now, we live in a poor area, but you know, you can disrupt the adjacent economy just like Las Vegas. I mean, there's only one business in that town, right?
Sure.
Right.
So,
and
yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, gambling is a weird thing, and it's not the way we should be able to go about our sovereignty. It's what we've been given. If we were able to go out and exercise our rights in a more traditional way, I think, and when I say traditional, I just mean the idea of hunt, fish, and gather. Mm. For me, the idea of hunt, fish, and gather, when you translate that into 2014, is food, clothing, and shelter. And the new canoe is the automobile. And the people that I work with primarily, there's so much poverty that if we weren't being improperly taxed by the state, and I would tell you that we are, I believe it's illegal, it's just too hard to fight sometimes, that we would have more money to spend in our adjacent communities, which would help everyone. But because the state itself is more interested in getting the money straight to its capital and then using it and then benefiting the state or whatever it calls it, it takes advantage of people who are historically disadvantaged and who maybe they don't even have a right to tax.
Now, hold on. Now, you are talking in your case here, Frank, about the state of Minnesota. Is that right?
Yes.
Now, and just so I've got this clear, you're saying that their taxing of you as Native Americans is illegal because you your treaties are directly with the federal government of the United States, and so they have no jurisdiction. Is that the point here?
That's a part of it. What happens is they try to wiggle around to make it into particular Indians. Congress deals with tribes and Indians, and unless it's something special for a particular tribe, they use those very generic terms. And so if Indians are not supposed to be taxed, that means whether you're an Apache, an Arapaho, a Comanche, or a Chippewa, where I am, none of us should be taxed. And they've gone as far, our tribe is pretty unique. We have at least six reservations with tribal governments with the Minnesota Chippewa tribe, plus other parcels of land throughout northern Minnesota. And as a result, even though we're one tribe, they want to say, well, you're six different tribes because you have six different reservations, and those other reservations, they don't have any interest in your rights. But I have interest in every one of those reservations as a Chippewa tribal member who has a treaty with the United States, because we have 44 treaties with the United States. And so the state doesn't want to learn to correctly understand how our rights work, because not only will it cost them money, they won't be able to get money from us. They might find out that they might not have as many rights as they've been using against us.
How does the state enforce this taxation if that taxation is illegal? I mean, actually, practically on the ground, what kind of taxes are we talking about?
Well, the problem is, I would say the one I'm talking about right now would be individual personal income tax.
Okay.
And there was a case back, I believe it's 1976, Bryan v. Itasca, where the Supreme Court told the state of Minnesota that you don't have the right to tax Indians on the reservation. And for a while, they didn't tax any Indians on the reservation. And that is what the Supreme Court meant, and that is what the federal law says. But then they started trying to figure out how to get to certain Indians, and they tried to narrow it down to whether you were Chippewa or not. And then after that, they started trying to narrow it down to whether, you know, you're living on the right reservation or not. And so if you're enrolled on one of those MCT reservations, and living on another, they might argue whether or not you can have your taxes. If you're enrolled, like Red Lake is another Chippewa reservation who used to be part of our group 100 years ago, because they're not part of our group now, the state says, well, then they don't count either. And so what you're doing is you're taxing the poorest people. You have a way to intercept any kind of rebate that they would be eligible for, and you have the guns and the badges to go out and try to enforce your law. You can criminally charge them. You can jail people. So you're really oppressing people to comply with a taxation that may not even be fair, just, or legal. And it may not even be beneficial to the state in all actuality.
Now, I would imagine that, well, you know what, actually, we're coming up to the break already, Frank. This segment has gone very quickly. So let's go into the break, and then I've got a few more questions about this when we get back.
Sure.
Welcome back to Blue Republican Radio with me, Robin Kerner. This is the second segment of this show. I'm talking to Frank Bibo about the abuse of rights retained by his tribe of Native Americans up in Minnesota. And right now we're talking about the enforcement of taxation by a state, the state of Minnesota, which actually, by the treaties and therefore by law, by, you might say, I guess, the constitution of the Native American nation, generally, if I can use that term, or set of nations, is illegal. So now this, I imagine that most of, or many of the people that would be seeking your help, or in this situation, being on the receiving end of illegal taxation, would actually be sufficiently poor that they're probably not, I mean, most of them wouldn't be liable for income tax just based on income, would they?
That's true for many people, unfortunately. But all you have to do is be liable 1 year and not pay taxes or get it as a rebate, and they want to go after it, and they can keep chasing you tax year after tax year, try to intercept, you know, any federal return you might get, or if you have the fortune to maybe get a state business license, they might try to go after your business license until they get the tax from you.
So basically, you know, they basically are targeting any aspect of a Native American's life that is kind of that exists off the reservation. Basically, they use whatever they can.
Yes. And I don't know that that's, you know, that's how the law has kind of ended up, but I don't know that that's really how it should be, because if you think about what things meant when we made treaties, the right to hunt, fish, and gather, being food, clothing, and shelter, those were the inalienable rights that we all understood in the Declaration of Independence. And the inalienable rights, it's oxygen, it's drinking water, it's finding food, it's love for every other animal. And so if we have those rights, and we do, you know, especially with treaty rights to hunt, fish, and gather, then the question becomes, if it's really food, clothing, and shelter, how do we recharacterize those concepts so that they're not taxable by the state and they understand it, and also by the federal government? And an example of that right now, I've got I had a contract with one of the local bands up here, and it was specifically to look at the 1855 treaty, and it spelled it out by federal statute and so forth. And I'm going to use that to also try to escape federal taxation, because when we are using our treaty rights to earn a living, we're not supposed to be taxed. Now, as an attorney, you wonder what an attorney would have done in 1832 or 1837 or whatever, but I'm also just a person who is making a living helping the other members of my community benefit from their efforts to hunt, fish, and gather in what would maybe be more of a bartering kind of a community. And so I'm just performing a service that others aren't able to perform in exchange for fish or deer or money.
Okay. So now, do you, this is interesting, do you have, okay, regardless of the treaties in which you retain the rights to food, shelter, etc., do you believe that income tax, philosophically, for the reasons you've just indicated, is is against natural law and against natural rights? Like, putting the treaties aside, is there a natural law basis for rejecting income tax?
If you are doing anything to excess, to where you are taking something out of the ecosystem and making it out of balance, then there should be some cost. I don't know what that is, but the rest of the people shouldn't have to pay for a lake with no fish in it just because someone figured out how to get all the fish out of it.
Okay.
It might not be a tax, but you have taken something from everyone. And, you know, is that a crime or was it just opportunistic because you could figure out how to get fish out of water, but do you still have the right to take food from everyone?
Right, you know, this is, I had no idea this interview was going to go this way, but one thing that, you know, one guy that libertarians obviously talk about a lot is Locke, John Locke, right? And he talks about the basis of property, you mix your labor with something that it comes from the land, and it becomes your property. And indeed, this the idea of homesteading, right? Also, you claim a piece of land, you put a fence around it, you nurture that piece of land, you produce from that piece of land, and then you have a property right in that piece of land that is an exclusive or an exclusionary property right. Now, one thing that a lot of libertarians miss about Locke when they make this kind of Lockean argument for the basis of property is that Locke said that works only insofar as the taking the exclusive right to that piece of property, i.e. removing that piece of property from a common access, does not significantly detrimentally affect the ability of all other people in the community to do the same thing. Are you with me?
I understand.
And so would you agree with Locke? Is that kind of as far as property rights go? I mean, it seems to be that's where you're kind of talking, where you were kind of pointing to with your answer to the earlier question.
Well, I was, but I would point to, and I can't remember the name of the river, but there's a river that flows in the Middle East that ultimately would get to, I guess, you know, where the Palestinians are or whatever, and be able to make it arid land irrigable and you could grow crops and all, and they've dammed up all the water so that nothing gets downstream to the next country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where before that, the rivers always flowed. So just because you're upstream doesn't mean that you have a right to take
right.
it all or deny.
Right, right. So do you,
right.
so do, is a lot of, does a lot of your work involve this issue of property rights? Is that why we kind of ended up, like, in started this interview and immediately went there, which, as I say, I wasn't expecting? It seems to be
right.
really at the basis of a lot of what you do in defense of the rights of Native Americans.
Well, it's kind of a funny thing because the elders remind me when I talk like this that these are not rights. These are gifts from the Creator. But when I talk to non-Indians, that confuses them because then they think, well, they're just gifts. It's no big deal to you. But if we characterize them in the non-Indian property right thing, then everybody knows how property is because they've got some,
yeah.
and they want to protect it, and they want to say it's theirs, and you can't do anything with it. And then they know how to respect our rights. And so what we've done is we've had to translate them into a language, and ironically, it's the people who characterize our rights to begin with. We're using their language back on them, and they have to actually say, well, you know, you're actually right, and we might have to defend your treaty rights now that you've characterized them in a way that shows us their property. Because one of the comments that you made right at the opening of your show, you talked about the way that the states abrogate our rights. Technically, Congress is the only one who can abrogate our treaty rights, and when they do it, they have to talk about why they have to do it, why they need to do that instead of something else, and then they have to compensate us for the loss of that treaty right.
Mm-hmm.
The states aren't under the Constitution. They get this in-between kind of stuff and get kind of ignorant, and they take stuff from us. They take stuff from all of us, and they don't have to compensate anybody. Well, in reality, they've taken a lot of rights away from us.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. The word we should be using here with respect to, like, the state of Minnesota and other states is simply violate, right? We're right. violating. That's what they're doing.
Right, right. And so, you know, most of us have parents and grandparents who have talked about when they were young during the Depression and other times where they would be having to go out and get get game or fish maybe at night or something, you know, shining or something, even though we actually have had the right the whole time, other people have tried to prevent us from exercising it to make us either have to pay fines or comply with their laws or maybe have to go out and get a job and pay for everything like they want us to, you know, get a house like everybody else, get a mortgage like everybody else, get a new car mortgage or a payment like everybody else. And in reality, we don't have to be like everybody else. We have our own right to exist the way we have and the way we want to in the future, separate and apart.
Okay.
To a large degree.
Okay. So, again, now, this is just whizzing by. We're coming to the end of the second segment. I'm interested in finding out in the next segment, you know, what the nature, the specific nature of some of the most egregious violations that you guys have to deal with. Thanks for being with me. We're going into the break. I got to say, this interview is going very fast. Okay, Frank, this is really interesting. We're talking in generalities here. What are some of the most egregious violations of your rights that you experience day to day as a Native American up there in Minnesota?
Well, I mean, if you talk about the most egregious, they got the whole country pretty much from us and took all the resources.
The historical one is probably not going to be beaten, is it?
No. So, but actually, I would go to the other end, and it kind of goes to what I was talking about in the beginning, the things that affect everybody. And one of the things that I've found is that by being an attorney and understanding what our rights are, it helps me understand the gaps or the voids in jurisdiction. And while it helps me help individuals, it doesn't always help me with everybody across the board, which is what I try to do. And so an example that I would give you, and this is how stupid it gets for our world, and from my perspective, I had a case several years ago where a father was being tried for felony failure to pay child support. He was a tribal member living on the reservation. His wife was a tribal member living on the reservation. The reservation I'm talking about is White Earth. It had they had two children. Everybody lived on the reservation. White Earth was starting up its own child support system. And so I was arguing that the state lacked jurisdiction to exercise criminal jurisdiction against this individual when the reservation had child support court and proceedings and so forth. The first thing the county said was, well, you don't have a jail. Well, that's presuming that the person needs to be punished and go to jail. And actually, that's what it ended up. The state wouldn't agree with me. And so they took someone who was poor, working in a poor place, put him in jail, convicted him of a felony, and then let him out 6 months later and said, go forth with your new felony record conviction, find a good job, you're behind on your child support, and get on it. Now, in our world, that just means you've got three more rocks on your neck and you ain't going no place.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't get the cause and effect and what it looks like at our end of the world. I was listening to a report the other day and they were talking about homelessness, but they didn't think about what some of the real definitions of homelessness are. Now, we think of people when we see them on the street. What happens when you go into a house and you see three or four families all living in that same house? Are they homeless? Or is just one family not homeless and the other three are?
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
And so it gets hard to understand what the picture looks like and what's happening to the picture. And so one of the things, and I think I talked about it that night when we made our presentation there in Minnesota here, with regard to a civil forfeiture of an automobile. You know, if the state lacks the ability to take a car from someone under civil forfeiture on the reservation for too much drunk driving, that car may be the only car in that house with three or four families with everybody who wants to go to work. And you take that one car away, and suddenly everybody's not able to get to work on time, get their kids to appointments, get kids to school. They look like they're bad parents. They take their kids away or start making them go to court for a while, all because one person had the car who maybe didn't even have a driver's license. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's really that culture shock where people, they don't understand the thoroughness or the depth of the gap. I was talking with a person the other day about, and I'll just call it police racism or police laziness, and this is where it gets really hard to figure out who's trying to do what job. There was a young man, whenever I go into court and I argue jurisdiction and I usually come out with a tribal member, there's other Indians in there who want to talk to me right away and say, hey man, my stuff's just like his, can you help me out? And so I was over in Itasca County and this young man comes out and he says, hey, I need to talk to you. And we're talking, and I said, well, what did they charge you with? And he said, well, not a drop rule. And I said, not a drop? I said, what's that? And he said, well, he says, I'm 20 years old, and if you're caught driving under 21 in Minnesota, they take your license until you're 21. And so they call it not a drop, just one drop, and you lose your license. And so I asked him, I said,
hold on, you think you lose your license for having drunk one drop of alcohol we're talking about here?
Right, until you're 21, until if you're underage.
Okay, so basically there's a zero limit for 20. Okay,
that's,
yeah.
Right. So you can imagine how that makes us all stop driving. Yeah. Yeah, a little humor there. So I asked him, I said, what made them pull you over? And he said, well, I didn't have any license plates on my vehicle. And I said, well, did they give you a ticket for that? And he said, no. And I said, well, if you didn't have any license plates, you probably didn't have a proper registration either, did you? And he said, no. And I said, did you have insurance? And he said, no. He said, did they give you a ticket for any of those? Nope. I said, how about driver's license? Nope. The only thing they gave him a ticket for was the one thing they could bring him to state court for the alcohol for the violation against his driver's license and then give him a fine. The other four would have caused the police officer to have to go to the reservation to tribal court to go and testify over there, and then the reservation would get the money.
Okay, so we're talking about selective enforcement here.
Right. Now, it gets so selective that one of the counties over here by White Earth, where I was talking about before, the county attorney, when I started making these arguments, she was so mad, and it was a poor county, that instead of transferring the tickets to tribal court, she would just dismiss them. And, you know, the police, the county sheriffs and all, are like, what are you talking about? This is public safety. And so actually the county deputies would take their tickets and give them to the tribal court because they want public safety. The county attorney wanted revenue. So when you're trying to figure out who's doing their job for what reason, you know, I was recently talking with a couple of people about a forged check. And typically law enforcement won't do anything with a forged check, especially if it's out of state and a bunch of other things. And so I was told that I should check, you know, with law enforcement anyway. And when I called, they said, oh, yeah, you should report it. Well, actually, I know that they're not going to try to figure out how a forged cashier's check from another state, you know, where the money went and who was involved. They're going to take that $49,000 and they're going to add it to the amount of money that they lost in a year through crime so they can get more police officers and more radar guns and more guns or tasers.
Yeah.
Right. They need the statistic filed so that they can point to it.
Right.
And so when you start to understand some of the cause and effect and you try to figure out, are we really trying to fix the problem or perpetuate the problem so that the haves and the have-nots kind of stay the haves and the have-nots?
So what is your feeling? I mean, if this is your kind of day-to-day experience of the law, how much faith do you have in the most basic principles of our law? I mean, do you know, we talk about common law, we talk about, you know, this, I talk a lot about this extraordinary thousand-year tradition that, you know, of which the Constitution is a part, and these kind of principles that we try and apply as, you know, if you have a jury of 12 peers and, you know, when it really matters. And do you think this is all just all great in theory and just nowhere in practice? Or, like, how do you relate to the law? What kind of respect do you have for it institutionally?
I think someone else should have to finish paying my student loans. I think I got ripped off. I say that because I'm up against a results-oriented system,
yeah.
And they don't want to do the job the right way because it's either uncomfortable, difficult, or distasteful, or whatever. And I'll talk about the most distasteful part of this, the law that I'm talking about, and that would be the civil commitment of sex offenders. And everybody, you know, everybody's against sex offenders, everybody's against violent crime, nobody wants anybody hurt, and the last thing we want is crazy violent people who commit sex acts to be free. But civil commitment is based on, here in Minnesota particularly, is based on either convictions or allegations. Now, if it's civil and it's a second remedy, it's like civil forfeiture, taking your car away for drunk driving. You know, you punish the person for drunk driving, you take their driver's license and you put them in jail, but you don't take their car because that's excessive punishment and it's civil.
Mm-hmm.
But now they have what they call a legal fiction called a civil remedy, and so they civilly commit people. And when we went through this for the Indian side of things, saying, look, you don't have civil jurisdiction on the reservation.
And this is, just to be clear, Frank, this is a fundamental principle of the relationship, the legal relationship between Native Americans and the United States, right? That they have
the state of Minnesota.
Oh, hold on. Are you saying that there are reservations where a state or the United States has civil jurisdiction?
Well, what I'm saying is, and we didn't talk about this, but in 1953, Congress gave Minnesota and six other states criminal jurisdiction for Indians on reservation and limited civil jurisdiction. And the limited civil was so, like, if two Indians wanted to get a divorce, they could go into state court and use the court to get divorced.
Okay.
But the state took it to mean they had full civil and full criminal.
Got it.
And so Justice Page, Alan Page, who used to be a Viking and everything else, and he's a person of color, and he's a great guy. It's really funny. He understands us a lot more when we write our briefs and some of the things. And what he wrote on this brief about civil commitment and registering as a sex offender was that it was shocking that it was criminal for people off reservation, it was civil regulatory for non-Indians and Indians, but on reservation it was criminal. And there is nothing that says that. He said it was shocking because it can't be both. And that's the problem, and that's what I found out with the U.S. government. The federal government was checking up on all 50 states on how they're conducting their civil commitment. And they had an 8 or 9 page questionnaire. It's very simple. And question 7 said, well, first let me say there was 50 states, 46 responded, 4 didn't. Minnesota didn't respond. Of the questions, and I think maybe there was 8 questions, question 7 said, are there any reservations in your state? And the question 8 said, are you working cooperatively with those reservations? Because you have to have a cooperative law enforcement agreement like you do with the police to stop people and give them a ticket so we can go to tribal court. That if you want to do something else that's civil against Indians on the reservation, you have to do it cooperatively with the tribal government.
Mm-hmm.
And the state didn't even want to answer the federal government and say, hell no, because they're not. And what they found out in Minnesota, essentially, is that it's a one-way system, that nobody has gotten out of civil commitment. It's supposed to be some kind of a curative place, and they found out that nobody goes out.
Hold on, nobody. What do you mean nobody goes out? Sorry.
Well, it's supposed to be... The reason that they can have civil commitment is because you're supposed to go and get healed there. It's a psychological hospital for people who have different kinds of mental issues.
Yes.
And ideally, that means at some point you should be able to be discharged. You should be able to be cured or something.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't had any luck with any of that. And they say that right now that there's like 300, I think there's 300 beds in there. They figure within 10 years they might have to have 1,200 people in there, or 1,200 beds. And it costs millions and millions of dollars to keep these people locked up. And so are they farming people? Are they labeling people so they can have a bunch of jobs for law enforcement or correctional facilities or social services? Who does all that? Well, it's not the Indians. We don't have a jail.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have law enforcement in that sense. We don't have correctional facilities. Our social services are inclined to try to solve the problem and put people back into the system quickly and not have them as a, whatever you want to call them, a customer or a client for years to keep your social services funded. And so some people think that we're just being farmed by being kept in poverty. And so if you get pulled over for, say, a cracked taillight, they look inside, there's some marijuana seeds on the floor, they write you a ticket for marijuana, they take your car, they tow it to the impound lot. You know, by the time you get out of jail the next day, there's probably a $90 tow fee and another $30 a day for storage, and you're trying to figure out how to pay a fine and get to a jail. Two or three days go by, and the car is now $200 to get out, and it's only a $400 car. Mm-hmm. I mean, these things are so quick that you end up starting over and over and over. And I've had people tell me that. And that's probably the most distressing part, is when people tell me, you know, this is the fourth time I've had to start over. And they mean start over with everything.
Yeah.
That I don't understand occurring in America. You know, your stuff isn't safe, you aren't safe. And they don't care how they get you, as long as they get you, is what it seems like. And they're so afraid that they don't want to go out and really be what community policing is. I mean, you look down there in, what is it, Ferguson in Missouri, that's scary stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I've done a lot of protest. I don't expect to be shot, but I do tell people I'm afraid that they will tase me because I'm over 6 foot tall and I'm over 300 pounds. And so I expect that someone's going to say, I was intimidated, and they're going to tase me, and I'm going to fall to the ground and hurt myself. You know?
What do you see? We've got like a minute and a half left in this segment. Okay. And we're coming, you know, we're not far from the end of the show. Just standing back from all of this, as you watch, you know, the America outside the reservation go down the road it's been going down, certainly the last decade, what is your feeling? Like, where do you think we're going? And what do you think we should be doing about it? And we've got 1 minute in this segment. We can come and revisit it at the end.
Well, I would tell you that right now, in my efforts to try to stop some of these pipelines with tar sands and Bakken oil coming through northern Minnesota Lake Country, that the non-Indian property owners are very hopeful that our treaty rights are the one thing that are going to save them, because they can see that they have no protection under state law and that the federal government doesn't have the same relationship with them because of Article 10 of the Constitution with states' rights. And so you actually have the people who have the wealth and the property who are actually hoping that the poorest people who have been here forever and who were historically disadvantaged are going to be able to exercise their rights and their unique relationship with the federal government to save everyone.
Does this have the power to make a significant difference to the standing of the Native American for the long term? And we've got like 30 seconds.
Yes, I think so, because there's a decision under appeal right now, but the decision says that these rights are individual property rights to hunt, fish, and gather. You're born into them. That's important to know, that you have those rights as a birthright, not someone gives you a license.
Birthright, like all of the rights that are supposedly enumerated in the Bill of Rights.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, we're going into the final break. We will be back in a few minutes. Thanks so much, Frank. One of the fastest hours I think I've had on this show. I really appreciate your coming on the show. Like I said, Frank, this is great. And I just feel like I started with a couple of questions and now I have a couple of hundred, and we probably need another 100 hours to answer them. But we don't have that. We have 2 minutes. What do you see? An increasing awareness of the average American of, let's say, the approach of his state and status toward that has been suffered by your people for a couple of hundred years. Are we waking up is what I'm asking you. Are we waking up?
I don't know if you're waking up or not, because it's capitalism and most people have been, you know, bought into it. I remember when my mother told me, and this is in the state of Virginia, that the county rezoned one side of the road going to their house commercial and the other side industrial, and the property taxes went up 700% to 1,000%. And she said that all the people were complaining and all the farmers who had their farms lost them. And I said, look, they've taken the land from everybody else of color. The only people they have to take it away from now are people who own it. And so they're doing it by pricing them off of the land that they have through their legal mechanisms.
Yes, yeah. Oh, wow. I mean, this opens up. This has really been a show about property rights. And, you know, libertarians, liberty folks always talk about property as kind of the final resort, the final means by which you can defend your natural rights. And that's why property is so important. And I think certainly people are waking up to the fact that they don't own what they think they own. When the state comes and says, we can just set the number that we're going to take from you because you have a piece of land there or property right here. Okay, Frank, thank you very much. Is there anything that you want to plug? We've got like 30 seconds here. Do you have a website? Do you have anything to put out there, even a number, anything?
Thank you. I'm working with Honor the Earth, but the website is honorearth.org. And we're working to stop some of these crazy Canadian pipelines who want to come right through our pristine natural lake country and risk it all like Kalamazoo. So help us stop them.
Thank you, Frank, and thank you for joining me for this hour.